Welcome to another weekly edition of Chatting with Charlie, hosted by Charlie Johnston, with his co-host, Dr. Joe Brickner, and presented by the Corps of Renewal and Charity. Visit us online at corac.co.
Welcome to Chatting with Charlie. I'm Dr. Joe Brickner. I'm host of Chatting with Charlie, and this is the seven questions version of the Chat with Charlie. Our co-host and star, is Charlie Johnston. Charlie is the founder of CORAC, which is the Corps of Renewal and Charity. He's also hosts a blog called A Sign of Hope. Today, in our seven questions, it's going to be pretty interesting. Charlie, I'm going to run through just real quickly some topics, that the seven topics that we're going to talk about, so that some folks have an idea of what's down the line. And obviously, if there's something that they don't really want to listen to, they can skip forward. But I doubt that will ever happen, because you are probably the most interesting person that anyone's ever listened to.
You know, I watch tapes of myself and I wonder, what do people see in me?
Okay. The first one is a question about aliens. The second one is a question about the Brazen Serpent Prayer. Third one is about God the Father, which we haven't had many questions like that before. The fourth one is concerning abortion and the politics of it. The fifth one is about what do we do at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning. And the sixth one talks about Freemasonry, which we don't hear a lot about that anymore either. It used to be a pretty big topic, but it's kind of going to the wayside some. And I saved the best one for last because I knew it'd probably take the longest. And it talks about Pope Francis. All right. Well, Charlie, if you're ready.
I'm ready.
We can hit that first one right off the bat. Okay, this one's about aliens. And this comes from Mary. And Mary says, more and more messages regarding aliens are being reported and how they could have been the ones to accomplish various miracles. And she talks about the lights in the night, different things that happen that people attribute to aliens or whatever. And she says, not necessarily that she believes in aliens, but she's asking, how do you respond to young people when they ask you about aliens? You know, are they real or are they not? And what type of response would you give to a young person, actually to any person?
Okay, very simple. They're real, but they're not what you think. Okay. Daniel O'Connor, a young theologian, very sincere. Daniel and I have a few areas of disagreement, but we are like this on aliens, and I believe he's written a full book about it. What you need to understand about demonic entities, do you ever wonder why nobody ever talks about fairies and goblins and leprechauns, except jokingly or, you know, as part of a fictional movie? Because people are not geared towards buying into that. I mean, back when I was a kid, the idea that aliens did all this stuff, that's been around forever. I mean, I remember hearing about how aliens had built the pyramids, and that explained anything that they couldn't explain. Some people would come up with aliens. I had the singularly good fortune to have as my astronomy professor at Northwestern, the fellow, Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Dr. Hynek headed up the Blue Book Project for the Air Force, the foremost expert in UFOs in modern history, okay? And he was a delightful man. I mean, he just played, I think he loved playing the absent-minded professor in class. But he would have a special seminar not a seminar, just a little talk on aliens that anyone could come to, on aliens and all that. And many people were saying, you know, some of his critics had said that there were no such thing, there were no such thing as aliens. So therefore, there could not be such a thing as UFOs. And Professor Hynek coined a phrase right there that I have used ever since. He said, these people are supposed to be scientists, and they're gripped by some ridiculous form of temporal provincialism. They think the only possible explanation for UFOs is aliens, and that there are no aliens, therefore there are no UFOs. He said, that's not how the scientific method works. The scientific method is that you find a phenomena. Is it a genuine phenomena or not? And then you try to find what it is. He said, I posit, yes, the evidence is compelling and powerful for UFOs, but I don't know what it is, and neither do they. And when they say that, they're just trying to push away something that may alter their worldview.
Hmm.
When I talk about fairies and leprechauns, demons are very opportunistic. They will take the form of whatever a culture is predisposed to think may be real. 400, 500 years ago, it was fairies, goblins, leprechauns, and all of that. People are not disposed to believe in that anymore, but they are disposed to believe that maybe there's aliens. So the demons, hey, we're not vested in being fairies and leprechauns. We'll be aliens for a while. That's what it is on these things. They're not, they are real, but they're demons. They're not actual aliens. And when you talked, when you first said we were going to start off about aliens, I wasn't sure whether you were talking about illegal aliens or aliens. But the whole point, another point it comes down to is, what difference does it make to your life, whether it is real or whether it isn't? This gets back to a key thing. I am adamant that they are not, that we are the only intelligent life in the universe. I have reasons for that that I'm not going to go into. I didn't always believe that, but I do firmly. Now, the question that you have to ask yourself, what difference is it going to make in your life, whether they are or whether they aren't? If they are, they'd be so powerful that you couldn't stop them. Or maybe they're just, well, if they managed to get here from across wherever, at warp speed, it doesn't make any difference in your life. It doesn't make any difference in what you're supposed to do. I was watching a show once, this was several years ago, about intelligent design. And they asked, how did life begin? And the fellow that was pushing for intelligent design, which I believe in also, was getting the better of the scientist who just wouldn't have anything to do with God. And the scientist that had nothing to do with God said, he was asked, how did life begin? He says, well, I think aliens created life here on Earth. And so the fellow asked, said, well, who created the aliens? He said it was aliens. I called it the turtles all the way down argument, which some scientists have been reduced to. I don't know if you ever heard that old story. Some people will know. The fellow was asked, what holds the universe up? And he said, it's held up on the back of a gigantic turtle. And so they asked him, said, well, what's holding the turtle up? And that guy looked and thought, and he said, it's turtles all the way down. you get from the scientific community a lot of turtles all the way down arguments these days, which is why I have growing contempt for them. They've got a degree. It's just like the old Wizard of Oz. At the end, when the Scarecrow, desperately wanting a brain, the wizard said, I can't give you a brain, but I can give you a diploma. It was never meant to be our national education policy, people.
Oh, well, good. Well, thank you. Let's move on to the next one. This is from Cindy, and it's about the Brazen Serpent prayer. And she says, and for those, I don't know if everybody's familiar with the Brazen Serpent prayer, but I know that you've told us in the past it's a very powerful prayer, but it's only to be used once.
No, that's the prayer of miraculous trust. Brazen Serpent prayer is a whole different deal.
I thought on the back of that card it actually
prayer on the back we print the prayer of miraculous trust. But to be used once, that only applies to the miraculous trust.
Oh, so that's not part of it. Okay, because I was
right. If you want.
Yeah, I looked on the back of that prayer card and okay. So that clarifies it for me especially. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Anyway, concerning the Brazen Serpent prayer, she says, why especially is it recommended for those who took the vaccines?
A lot of people took the vaccines because they were scared or because they were coerced. The focus of the prayer is to get us back into right relation with God and healing. God is responsible for all healing, whether we use his natural means or whether he uses his supernatural means. The COVID stuff, the COVID shots, was what triggered me. That this is important, this has got to be done, because the COVID shots create a lot of problems. It's well known now, the myocarditis, you got young people, you still got young people dropping dead every week of mysteriously myocarditis, and they've all been vaxxed on things. You got the increased all-cause deaths. When they were doing the studies of mRNA vaccines with animals, what the mRNA vaccines did was they would give you some limited protection against what they were giving it for, but at the cost of progressively degrading your immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So that you were not able to fight off routine things. Almost all of the animals died within 3 years because their immune systems were destroyed. Now, I know that God does not intend our destruction. He intends our reclamation. So it was put up specifically it was triggered by the COVID vaccines, because a lot of people, through little fault of their own, took them, and they were going to suffer consequences because of it. The fundamental thing is not just to ask God to heal you and let it go, but get you back into right relationship with God. God does not want to destroy us. He wants to reclaim us. And that's where it came from, you know, originally with Moses, when the Israelites rebelled in the desert. God sent vipers to bite them. And they were dying. The COVID shots, the mRNA shots, they are the vipers that came this time. But God instructed Moses to put up a brazen serpent on a pole, and everyone who looked at it and asked for forgiveness would be healed. Okay? This progressive degradation of your immune system, science has no way to stop that. I have seen credible evidence that there have been 17 million excess deaths globally of the vaccinated that are not explained. So you turn back to God, realize that science is not the healer. Science can help discover the natural means God has for healing, and we shouldn't spurn God's natural means. But we need to be careful. We need to use basic logic, evidence, and common sense to determine, is this something that's right or not? People went too far. They just trusted authority for everything, and authority were a bunch of lying weasels. But God doesn't want his people to be destroyed because of it. Mm-hmm. He wants us all to take a lesson. And that's what it was all about. But in the larger sense, while that was the catalyst for it, that was not the primary purpose. It's to get us back to right relationship with God and what is the source of all healing. I say that if you demand God's supernatural healing when his natural means are easily available to you and are well documented and credible, then you are demanding something you have no right to demand. You know, pretty arrogant to say, God, I will not accept an aspirin to get rid of my headache. You've got to do it supernaturally. Well, there are times when he'll do it supernaturally, but everything that is, whether it's natural or supernatural, is from God. But we have a responsibility. So, simply, the responsibility, as they say, what was the old saying? Let the buyer beware. Mm-hmm. In Latin, you know it, don't you?
You know, I took 2 years of Latin in high school, and I couldn't tell you much other than Dominus Vobiscum.
Okay. Dominus Vobiscum.
Well, you know, that brazen serpent, when Moses was in the desert and he created that, I don't know if people are aware of The Chosen, which is a great series. I mean, and they have, as an introduction into one of the episodes, they have Moses creating the serpent to put on the cross. And Joshua comes in and says, what are you doing? I mean, that's making an idol. And he says, how can you do that? And they get into a heated discussion, the two of them. And Moses finally says to him, I'm doing what I'm told to do. and he puts it up. And if people who were bitten by those snakes, if they looked at that cross, they were healed. So I don't know if people do watch The Chosen. If they don't, they really ought to take a look at it, because it is, in my opinion, it is outstanding. They do a great job of portraying how things were back in the time of Jesus. But anyway... All right, Charlie, thank you. Let's go on to the next one. This is from Jerry McFadden, our buddy. He always has a good one or two.
He's going to give me a tongue twister.
And Jerry says, when praying to God the Father, what image should come to mind? He said, is it revealed anywhere what he looks like?
Well, I guess you could imagine him as a burning bush. No, I don't know of any place where it is. God the Father is pure spirit. God the Holy Spirit is pure spirit. God the Son is both man and God. One person, two natures. And that pure spirits can take on any form they wish to. So something that's comforting to you, it seems perfectly legitimate to me. I mean, just take a look at Mary, who is spirit and body at this point. All of the images of her, many of them, most of them don't look alike. After she was assumed into heaven, she takes on the form that is most comforting to the people she's speaking to. Look at the angels, and the angels, they're tricky beings. If they're coming to give you comfort, they take on a form that is likely to comfort you. If they're coming to kick your rear end, they'll take on a form that will make you know that your rear end's being kicked. So, you know, Jerry, I would say this. If you need a good, swift kick in the rear end, then imagine God as an NFL punter, the Father. If you need some comforting and all that, imagine him as the kindly old grandfather.
This isn't part of Jerry's question, but I think people really struggle with God the Father. Some people do pray to God the Father. And I could be wrong here, but I think most people pray to Jesus because he was one of us and really does understand, not that God the Father wouldn't. But I know I've had relatives talk to me about God the Father and the Old Testament and everything. And they say, I really don't believe a lot of the stuff in the Old Testament because God is cruel. He is just cruel. And what I try to explain to them is that, no, he set up some rules and people didn't follow some rules. And yeah, he punished them. But God's love and the New Testament is just a fulfillment of the Old Testament. And
yes, it is. And if this is all there is, then you can make a legitimate case that God is cruel. If this is the forerunner to eternal life, then the good is what is most likely to get us into heaven. And I'm going to say something that's going to be offensive to some people, because that's what I do every now and
then. I was going to say, this is a first.
You think about it. You look something with the current dispute between Israel and Hamas and the Palestinians. Everybody keeps talking about the innocent Palestinians. 71% think it was right to murder and rape babies and children and young women on the thing. Palestine, as far as I'm concerned, they can find another Arab country to come take them out. But I would fully support Israel if they took them out root and branch, pure and simple. You look at that thing when you've got one entity that will not stop over, geez, 70 years? Every time you've given them a little bit, they use whatever money you've got to buy weapons and systems, and they try to kill you. They never build a country and all that. Take them out root and branch. The only way you're going to have peace is when Palestine is wiped completely off the map of the Middle East, of Israel. I do want it to be all one from the river to the sea. All Israel.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got people, you saw the videos, normal people were cheering when they brought dead and broken women in and spitting on them and all that. These people have got to be stopped. And this is what God dealt with in the Old Testament. It's not that God was different, it's that we were different. We were more primitive, more tribal. You have a leftism in America, in the Western world, that is now pushing tribalism. You know what happens when you push tribalism? You've got never-ending conflict, and the only way to end the conflict is completely to destroy your antagonist on that. Some of those antagonists are going to be decent people. Some of them are not, and everything. This is the reason why you don't push tribalism. America had created a system where multiculturally we could live in peace together. And the idiots on the left that are geniuses in their own mind have done their dead level best to destroy that. It's over.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Charlie. Going to the next one. This is from a certain Connie. This question about abortion says, what do you say to Republicans or politicians basically in general who say we need to compromise on abortion to gain at least some footing to move forward some politically? In other words, I think what really struck her was when she was watching one of the debates and Nikki Haley basically came out and said, hey, we need to meet them halfway or partway down with the abortion issue. She wouldn't say, no, abortion's wrong and it doesn't matter what, we got to stop it. It was, hey, let's meet them halfway because we aren't going to be able to get elected if we don't. And that's a real question, you know, what do you do, especially if you're a politician and what do you do in that type of situation?
Well, we put this in the context that I think that all the politics is going away. and I think it's likely to go away this next year on things because we have so badly messed everything up. But let's pull back from that. Incremental change versus immediate and comprehensive change. That's long been an argument on that. St. John Paul said that politicians, that political officials could support legislation that still allowed for abortion as long as what they were supporting would reduce the number of abortions on that. I think Connie's question touches at something else. And incrementalism has a great, for me, whatever is most effective at ending it is what I support. Abraham Lincoln, great example of incrementalism, the Emancipation Proclamation. Many people think it freed all the slaves. It did not. It declared the slaves in territories in rebellion forever free. It was posited as a war aid so that those slaves would be more likely to join forces with the Union when they came in. All of those territories that were still loyal to the Union that had slaves, it specifically exempted them. Now, Lincoln knew what he was doing. He only partially freed the slaves, but he knew that once he got the North to buy this as a war aid, then if the North won, slavery would be forever ended. If the North didn't win, it would probably be spread across the continent and everything. He did something incremental that had a poison pill in it to destroy slavery forever. That was brilliant. None of the absolute abolitionists had a way to end slavery completely. In fact, all they did was tend to inflame things. So there is a place for incrementalism. Right now, the real question is, you've got a lot of Republican politicians who just want to win again, scared that the that abortion has not been a winner for us. And so they're wanting to go back on a thing. That's the real issue here. Now, just without going into details, I have spent probably the last quarter talking with some top pro-life leaders that this is our fault. We've let the left seize the narrative. They make all of these stories, but the reality is they are making huge profits. They don't want abortion to end. They're trafficking baby parts. They're doing things. We've got to take the initiative. We've got to show some of these things with abortionists laughing about eyeballs rolling around and how they get the organs that they need to make the maximum profit again. You just recently had the Daily Wire covered it, picked up on it. Several outlets have picked up on it. You recently had the Center for Medical Progress write about the University of Pittsburgh, which is under federal investigation for indeed trafficking. We need to get that stuff up. A problem for us is that, of course, Judge Orrick, the federal judge from Planned Parenthood, has put a stay, I'm not using the right legal terminology, but he banned some of these videos from being shown. One of the big things that's critical here is that in the congressional investigation, they have all the videos. Mm-hmm. And that judge cannot stay Congress from releasing what they have as their property. And that's something I'm working on that I've been pushing pretty hard. We need to get Congress to release those videos so that you see these people don't give a hoot about women. They don't give a hoot about babies. What they give a hoot about is protecting their profit center at the expense of murdering babies. And that's what they're doing. Let's show them, let's show the general public who they are.
Charlie, that isn't the first time I heard that about Congress having that. And I don't remember if I heard it from David DeLeiden or if it was in his representation, the legal people that he has. And if Congress does have those videos, why in the world would they not be pushing to show those? I mean, I just don't understand that.
Professional staffers or candy butts and all that. I've been through this business that I've been through this business of all the congressional people saying for the last year that, well, we've got to get the right time. In the meantime, we lost Kansas, we lost Ohio, we lost that. They said, now is the right time on that. I will say, somebody who has been at the leading edge, not just by his talk, but by his actions on doing this, is Congressman Chip Roy of Texas.
Yeah.
He's become a great hero of mine. There are plenty of congressmen out there that talk boldly, but they're shivering in their boots when it comes time to act on the stuff. So, you know, that senator from Missouri, Josh Hawley, we've got some real, true pro-life people out there, but we don't have near enough.
Yeah. Okay, and then let me clarify one other thing, too. I've heard you say this before, that the incrementalism, I'm glad you got into that because it does help with us as voters, that if it does move the ball down the road in preventing more abortions, you're saying it's okay to go ahead and vote for that.
Pope St. John Paul issued a specific instructions on that.
Okay. I have heard you say before, though, that it's a time to choose.
Yes.
It's a time to choose right from wrong.
Right.
So individually, personally, on the abortion issue, we have to either choose to support pro-life or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's 100%. That's not...
Yes, it is. But there is nothing wrong with me. If I have a choice between somebody who's going to give me nothing and somebody who's going to give me a half a loaf when I'm dying of hunger, it's perfectly licit for me to vote for the one who's going to give me half a loaf. The big problem, though, is a lot of the times the people who tell you they're going to give you a half a loaf, they keep the loaf for themselves and you can starve.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but it comes down to what is your intent. Okay, you need to be reasonable. You need to use everything you can to figure it out, to figure out whether they're on the level based on their track record, what they're saying, and all that. I mean, you know, you can often tell by what people say where they stand. Like, you remember when Mitt Romney said, "I'm severely conservative." I mean, as soon as he said that, you know, he ain't no conservative. but you do your best on things. Never lose sight of the main goal, which is to end abortion and to get people to see that this takes a genuine human life. America, culturally, we have become the biggest mass murderers in history. And we think there's never going to be any takeaway from that. I look at things like, think about this. If you are a child in a big pro-abortion family, how can you believe that you are loved for your very self? All you can really believe is that you are a random survivor of the brutal gauntlet the womb has become.
Mm-hmm.
And then that creates a nihilistic outlook. This is why you've got kids in the inner city that'll shoot each other to get tennis shoes. I personally think that's a big reason why you've got so many mass shootings, because people think that that life has no meaning.
Yeah.
Life has profound meaning. Yeah. And this is really what we've got to get back to. We've got to win not just minds, but we've got to win hearts, that we don't kill the most vulnerable among us.
Next question is from Steve Seeberger, which he's been kind of active in our CORAC organization. The first question that he asked, and it's not a part of this here, but he did want to know where we were with the manuals that you were putting together and the economic plan.
And I was right on the verge of doing that, but then I added, after October 7th, I added the Korat Defense League to the whole mix. And that kind of changed everything. And I got to figure out how explicit, how hard I want to be with that. And then you get into the holidays and everything. So I have been completely remiss. But I also think having a Korat Defense League, having a defense team that involves both police, ex-military and everything, and strategies for how you protect your community is critical on everything. Mm-hmm. But that is job one to finish that. I just don't know how much. I may have very little about it in there. I'm trying to figure out how much. I didn't want to issue a manual that immediately would go into revision at all. That's all.
Okay.
So, I mean, legitimate criticism.
Steve's real question was about, you had instructed us in CORAC that if things go bad, that we should show up on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. at our local church and gather the people together, you know, let it be known to people that we will be there and we'll be there to help. But he says, what are we going to do? You know, if you got people there that are hungry and angry, and he said, what do we do?
What we do is, first of all, we didn't create this mess. We're trying, with your help, to come up with ways to solve the mess. Now, we're going to do some foraging. We're going to go through food supplies. We're going to go through that so that nobody starves. But your anger, if you're angry at me for trying to marshal, get everybody together to work together to solve the problems that our elites have created, your anger is misdirected. We've got to work together now, or else the elites win and they just destroy everything, you know? But I do think you're not going, I think it unlikely that you're going to see a mob of angry people. You may see a mob of some hungry people. More likely you'll see some people, a lot of people that are very scared, because the whole terms of society will have suddenly changed. And honestly, fear often presents as anger, which is why it's so important for you, particularly if you're in leadership, to hear not just what people say, but what they mean. Sometimes when they're furiously angry, what they are is they're scared to death, and they need you to give some reason, to give them some reason to believe that we can work our way through this. And that's what you want to do. First, get small things. Let us gather food stuff together. Let us, you know, get a community watch together. Let's get some things where we help, particularly those people that are most vulnerable. I mean, you got the 80-something-year-olds laying at home, a bed, or not able to move. We need to take care of those. What we need to do, what's absolutely critical, is that we act as the caring community God has always called us to be at that point. And it will dissipate the anger very quickly. Even if you do one simple thing like, you know, okay, Mary, what have you got that we can add to the food supplies? Well, I've got, you know, a sack of flour, and I've got some beans and all that. And what have you got? And then you start figuring, okay, how can we get this so everybody is going to be able to eat and feed their children? That will calm people very, very quickly. And I know it will, because I've done these sorts of things before with angry crowds.
You know, the key will be, I guess, we're going to have to provide the leadership for that to happen. You know, so we basically got to have somewhat of a plan going in.
I think maybe we'll do another podcast early on in the year. There is a fellow from FEMA, I think you know who I'm talking about. And if he could appear, he did a great presentation in Denver on preparedness and basic things. I mean, he's just fabulous and very practical. And I would like to have him to give people some ideas of what you do at the very start.
Hmm. Okay, that's great. I'll put that on the to-do list. All right, let's move on. This one's from Mary Curran, and she said that our driver from Libya, a taxi driver apparently, made an interesting comment about Freemasonry, and then being behind all these terrorist groups. He also stated that Trump's connection with Putin was based on Freemasonry, both seeing that that's a problem. Says, what are your thoughts on that issue?
Okay. On Freemasonry, I have long been, and if somebody can prove me wrong, that's fine, but I've long thought that, you know, people have to have a boogeyman. And they jump on Freemasons. We blame Freemasons for everything as Catholics. The truth is, in Eurasia, Freemasons started as an anti-Catholic, anti-Christian organization, bluntly. In America, Freemasons are primarily guys that like to wear funny hats and drive little motorcycles while doing charitable work, okay? I hate seeing, I was invited several times to join some Masonic temples, which I did not for various reasons, but these were good people. They were the salt of the earth in America. These are not the sinister, vicious people going around. And if we can come up with one entity that is to blame for everything, it makes us feel like we have control. We do not. There is one entity that is to blame for almost all evil, and that's the Satan and all that. And he loves to get us focused on one organization and rip them up all the time. Do I think the Masons are behind most of the terrorist organizations? No, that's Islam. Islam, there are many wonderful Muslims, but Islam itself is a satanic deception. Specifically there to destroy people, okay? They don't need no Freemasons to tell them that, hey, I want to blow myself up and take 20 people with me on this stuff. Quit looking for easy answers to everything. And would somebody that is part of a group that that is responsible for these things, try to deflect responsibility to another organization? Oh, if I'm Libyan and I'm Muslim and I know Catholics just love to blame Masons for everything, might I not say that, you know, the Masons are really the ones that come up with this stuff? I'll tell you a little story. Back when I was a young fella, before the Iranian Revolution, mm-hmm. where they took hostages, I was working, I was training as a hotel manager. Well, we had a formal dining room. And I was training in there. I was just getting started. So I was a maitre d', you know, and the head maitre d', Kamel Masri was his name. He was teaching me everything. He didn't like much of anybody, but he liked me for some reason.
What's not to like?
I told you one time, we did the flaming at the table, you know, for everything. And he says to me one time, doing the flambeau cooking, and all that, he comes up to me and says, Dudley, this is the way he spoke. Dudley, I notice you seem to like skinny girls. I said, yeah, I do. He says, I like fat ones. So from now on, you get the skinny girl tables, I get the fat girl tables. He was Iranian, and he was very proud of it. And then when that hostage crisis came, mm-hmm. He said, Dudley, if anyone asks, I'm Jordanian. You know, it's human nature on the thing. There is one evil mastermind, and that is Satan.
Okay.
Be careful not to disparage a particular group just because it's your convenient scapegoat. And particularly when somebody that's from one of the groups that's doing all this tries to redirect you to something. That's my take on it. Now, others will have different takes, and I don't begrudge anyone else from having a different take, because I don't think it's particularly dangerous to their souls ultimately. But I don't like chasing after that stuff.
Okay.
Keep in mind, George Washington was a Freemason. Benjamin Franklin was a Freemason. John Adams was a Freemason.
That's just amazing. I didn't realize all those guys were Freemasons. But one of my Christmas presents was a book on George Washington. I'm looking forward to reading that. Because I read somewhere that a mysterious lady appeared to...
And that did not first surface until 99 years after George Washington was dead. That's complete tomfoolery.
Is it?
Yes, it's complete tomfoolery.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see if this book addresses that at all. Okay. Saving the best for last. This is a question David Aguilar had sent in. He says, you frequently spoke about the storm and the collapse of society. Is Pope Francis part of the forces of the evil one? And David has a real concern that, you know, that he may be, and would like some clarification. And I thought, since that question was brought up with the recent statement that was published out of the Vatican about the blessing of homosexual couples, same-sex couples. I read the actual words in that, and I think there's a lot of misinformation that's going around about what was said. You know, I was watching a TV program last night. It was on Fox, and they brought a guy in. He was a priest. They didn't say where he was from, but he was a U.S. priest. And he made it look like the Pope was saying that it's okay to bless same-sex marriages. And that's not what was in the document that was published. It was basically, if you got a group of people and you're going to bless them, and there's a same-sex couple in that group of people, you bless them, and that's okay. You can't not bless the two that are in there that way. Another example they gave was if someone was, a priest was walking down the street and the same-sex couple came up to him and asked to be blessed, he can't bless the couple and their relationship, but he can bless them. Basically, I read into it individually, you know, they can bless them. So this whole question on the Pope, you might start with what David was talking about. You know, is the Pope part of this evil?
Get right to it. First of all, if you bless a person, it doesn't matter who the person is. Your blessing is to call them to get closer to God and to go through. So you could be blessing Ted Bundy, and it's a legitimate blessing. Mm-hmm. When you bless a group, you are blessing not only the people involved, but what unites them. Okay? So if you are blessing a group from Alcoholics Anonymous, you are blessing their efforts to move away from
alcoholism.
Mm-hmm. If you bless a group of mafia hitmen, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
There's always that in there. If you bless a couple in a homosexual relationship, you're not only, you're explicitly blessing those two people, but you're implicitly blessing what unites those two people in seeking that group blessing. That's the danger in it. The people who say that this has changed nothing, they are right. The people who say that this has changed everything, they are right. What happens? For example, when the Roman Empire fell, I'm not talking about when the Roman Republic fell, what it had done for a long time, and the fall of the Roman Republic and the fall of the Roman Empire are two entirely different things. But the Roman Republic, what had happened was Rome, the emperors, kept the forms of liberty while robbing them of their substance. they were really more of a parody of what they had been. But people were able to go through, you know, typical motions that they had always gone through, and it felt like everything was the same. I mean, who was it? One of the emperors, and I got him on my, maybe Claudius, who had appointed his horse a senator. I mean, he made it very explicit what a joke it had become. Now, on the flip side, if you're trying to prepare a people for a substantive change, the best way to do it is to change the form in an innocuous way. The Vatican has changed the form in preparation for changing the substance, but the substance is not changed yet. Even though in any sort of analysis, when you bless a group or you bless a couple, you're also blessing implicitly what unites that group or couple. So it is deadly dangerous while seeming to change nothing.
Would seem like a slippery slope to me.
Oh, yeah. And as we have learned about slippery slopes over the last 50 years, yeah, you always end up sliding down them, don't you?
Yeah, you really do. Taking that then a step further, is Pope Francis part of the evil plan?
I think, perhaps unintentionally, Pope Francis is part of God's plan. I don't know. I mean, some people will try to attribute evil to Pope Francis, and I don't completely discount that. But one of the things to be is that he's just not very bright. He's very willful and not very bright. I mean, the Jesuit order, they have traded off intellectual rigor for ideological pretensions, and it hasn't done them any favors. And Pope Francis was trained by Jesuits in that era where it's all ideology, you know. So he made, you know, I was talking to a theologian about that, about is he evil and all that, and he said, well, maybe he really doesn't understand what he's doing. I said, yeah, he's done. Certainly willful. He's decided, certainly, that he is the successor to Christ rather than the successor to Peter. And that's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. But it really is a question for us. Can we maintain fidelity to the magisterium, to Scripture and the magisterium, while also living our legitimate duty of obedience to lawful authority? When the Pope or the bishop tells you to do something that's sinful by its very nature, he is contradicting his authority. He doesn't have authority to do that. If the Pope tells you to go commit adultery, he does not have that authority. He is the guardian of it. But I nonetheless say that he is part of God's plan. Now, God, he's a very tricky fellow. he gives us free will. But whatever we do, he always gets his way in the end. If we choose badly, he is so, you know, he knows everything. He knows how to bring good out of that. Mm-hmm. If you had had another pope, like Benedict the 16th or like St. John Paul, who were completely orthodox and determined to share the faith, preserve the faith, and bring people in, we wouldn't see. If we had another pope like that that came in when Francis did, we would not see the deep rot that there is in the hierarchy. And there is a lot of deep rot there. I say that the main thing that Pope Francis has accomplished is expose the depth of the rot that has taken hold in the Vatican and the hierarchy. Here's a fact. Pope Francis won't be here forever. But those who thought they were getting on the side that was winning and waged war on the magisterium and on the words of Christ are forever exposed. And now it becomes, what are we going to do about it? If we decide that there is no authority at all there, then we have failed we have betrayed Christ, because there is. If we decide just do whatever they say, even when it contradicts Christ, the apostles and the magisterium, we have betrayed Christ. Christianity is not for wimps. We are called to live it well, and we can. How many times have I said, this is the hour of the ordinary man? That is one of the central things that I have pushed on this stuff. And Pope Francis has made it much easier for it to be the hour of the ordinary man because of our faith, our fidelity to the magisterium, and our obedience to legitimate authority. That's the key. In the early, you know, I've said this before too, but repetition can be useful. In the early, in the first millennium of the church, the great controversies were over the nature of Christ. And you had, you know, people, I mean, Santa Claus punched the guy in the nose, in the face because of the heresy, St. Nicholas. I mean, these were not genteel Marquis de Queensberry fights. This time it's over what is the nature of the spiritual authority of a pope or a bishop? What are its limits? And what is the extent of it? We have to live both. I told Joe back, it's over 20 years ago, quarter of a century ago. I told my priests that direct me, they're all Opus Dei. I'm not a member, I am a cooperator. And Opus Dei takes great pride in its fidelity to the magisterium and its loyalty to the Holy Father. And at that time, I had told each of them that it's easy to be loyal to John Paul, Pope John Paul. But you need to prepare yourselves for a time when you have an authority that is not easy to be loyal to. And then you have to be thinking about how to live your mutual duties, your duty of fidelity to the magisterium, and your legitimate duty of obedience to authority over you. Well, that's what we all live right now. It's rough, it's ugly, there's a lot of mud and blood involved. But in the end, we will come out with a much better idea of what our duty is. It's going to clarify that five things a lot. What our duty both of obedience is and what our duty of fidelity is. We have more responsibilities than we think. And those, I'm going to say it. Okay, I'm going to be offensive again. Those chumps who think that they are going to be right with God by doing whatever the Pope says, whether it contradicts Christ or not, boy, are they going to have a surprise. And those chumps who say that if a legitimate apostle errs in one thing, he has no authority whatsoever, they are going to be accountable to Christ. We have to live our legitimate duty of fidelity to the magisterium, Scripture, and Christ, and our legitimate duty of obedience to lawful authority. So this is going to be very clarifying.
Well, that brings a question to me. I know that Archbishop or Cardinal Strickland, Archbishop Strickland.
Bishop Strickland.
Yeah, he was relieved of his duties.
Right.
And people in Tyler are really upset. A lot of people in Tyler are really upset about that. But
yeah, at the least. I know how upset they are.
Yeah.
They're mad as heck too.
it's legitimate though that the Pope can do what he did in this case.
I don't know if it's legitimate or not. He gave no canonical reason for it. You have to see each of the bishops, they are not branch offices of the Vatican. They have plenary authority over their diocese. In all other cases in history, there's been at least some effort to make a canonical reason for the removal. The Pope does have the power to to remove a bishop, but only if that bishop has done something that seriously violates the canons. Pope Francis gave no reason.
Well, probably other than he's been criticized by Strickland.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you this question I would have had, that the statement that came out about blessing same-sex couples was published by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of Faith. What is that compared to the Magisterium?
Well, you know, Cardinal Burke used to head that up. Cardinal Mueller headed that up. And now we have a guy whose main claim to fame is writing homoerotic literature in Argentina who heads it up. That determines, that says what is legitimate and what is not. But again, when a pope starts contradicting Christ, you've got a problem. When the head of the Dicastery for the Faith starts contradicting Christ, you also have a problem. And frankly, Joe, the bishops throughout the world, the bishops that I know, and I know a lot more of them than people think I do, and faithful priests, they are more concerned about Cardinal Fernandez, who heads the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, than anything else. I am kind of enthused because I think Cardinal Fernandez is, he's a lightning rod for scandal. I think he is likely to be the catalyst for bringing this whole nonsense down ultimately.
So where's
let me say something about magisterial teaching. If you're going to do something that is defined doctrine, it has to be rooted in what the church has always said. Now, you can find facets that you haven't seen before, but you cannot contradict previous doctrine. We are on a new and dangerous trajectory where the people who are charged with guarding the faith think they can contradict doctrine. If they can't, then the Catholic Church isn't true and our house is built on sand. But they can't. The thing is, people want immediate answers about it when abuses come. I think it's no mistake that Jesus chose Judas to be one of his original 12 apostles because he knew we were going to have people who were unworthy or even working against the faith in the time. And if he had someone right from the beginning, then we wouldn't lose our minds over it, but live patiently and trusting that God always, and he always does, gets his way.
Who makes up the magisterium?
Bishop.
And how many are there? Is it
in the world? Oh gosh!
I mean, is it all bishops?
Yeah, it's all bishops.
Okay,
that's their job. But there's a process it goes through. It's got to go through the Vatican. It's got to go through the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith and everything to be legitimized. But if it is not grounded in the traditional teaching of the church and doesn't specifically say that and show how, then certainly a rogue head of the dicastery could say that things that are not magisterial are. Okay. We've had rogues before, going back a while, saying that Jesus was not man at all, that he was just God. Basically, Halloween mask.
Yeah.
That controversy raged for a while before it was put right. The key is, Jill, it's always put right. God always puts it right. What people miss often is they think that this is immediate. It can rage for decades. These controversies can rage for decades, but it is always put right.
if somebody wanted to learn about this stuff, but the magisterium and the dicastery and those types of things, where would they go to learn about that?
Oh, gosh. To read the church fathers, that's a difficult one for me to answer because I read so much. And when I got something that is a question, I mean, I study a million different source documents to tell me, and that gets it to me. One thing I would say, do not just read for stuff that confirms what you already believe. Read stuff that attacks it as well. If you do that and read the full material, you will be able to defend your position. I mean, you could read the canons, canon law, read all of the canons, but if people read canons, they often don't understand completely what their implications are. Yeah. If you read, and I would not read the current CCD, what is that? I wouldn't read the current catechism. If you can get a catechism, say, from 96, then that you can, because frankly, the Vatican has changed some items in the catechism or just dropped things entirely, which they didn't have authority to do on the stuff just because of what they felt. So, I'm not giving you a good answer on this.
Well, we can use this as the number one question on our next 7 questions.
Okay. I will get a better answer for you.
All right.
I mean, if you're reading everything, not everything, but you're reading extensively, and anytime a question comes up, a real question comes up that you're not sure of, if you read almost everything written on the subject until you can come to it, then, you know. I mean, when I came into the Catholic Church, my first thing was to study all of the documents. I mean, I read all the documents of Vatican II. I read a whole bunch of the church fathers and everything. I was looking for the catch that would knock it out. And there was no catch. Now, did I have priests? Did I have deacons? Did I have tell me things that were not correct? Yeah, I did. But what was actually stated and printed, it was correct. It was coherent and it all held. And God bless them. These, sorry, the dog is. I'm going to kick you in the head, dog.
I thought I saw a puppy behind you a little bit ago.
She's wanting to get her beauty rest. I mean, you go through those sort of things and you try to find what it is. It does hold. And what I was going to say for those priests and deacons, I mean, God bless them. After a while, they would start soliciting my take on the stuff. In fact, one time teaching RCIA, which I did for 5 years, I think, our pastor, who had taught church history at the seminary in Mundelein, Illinois, the guy that was doing the presenting, he got a question and he said, I'm not sure what the answer to that is. I said, we better check with Father Bevan. And Father Bevan looked and said, you know, I'm not entirely sure either. We better check with Charlie. They were very kind to me.
Well, you are a source of knowledge. You certainly are that. So. Well, Charlie, yeah. That's the extent of the questions we had. Is there anything else that you'd like to address to our audience before we finish with our favorite prayer?
Well, other than buckle up, it's going to be an exciting year. I'll leave it at that. Okay. Let's finish with the favorite prayer.
Yeah, well, let me remind people of how they can get their question answered. If they'll send an email to 77questions@gmail.com, that's spell out the word 7 and then the number 7 and then the word questions. So 77questions.gmail.com, and that'll come to me and I'll put together, and I do these in as they're received. So the sooner I receive it, the sooner it's going to get on one of our podcasts. So with that, let's do finish with the prayer.
Okay.
In the name of the Father, and Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Saint Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. We humbly beseech God to command him, and do thou, O Prince of the heavenly host, by the divine power, cast into hell Satan and all the other evil spirits who prowl through this world seeking to ruin our souls. Amen. Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
Okay. You know, I go around and I tell everybody that they say this differently everywhere in the country. You say it your way and I'll say it mine. And still, the one thing I always said, St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in the day of battle. I'd say day of battle. It's like everybody has decided, okay, enough about day of, and they just say battle anymore. Yeah. It still irks me. Although once I was down at EWTN, and I was riding around with a deacon and a priest, good Irish priest, and he knew what I did. So when we said the St. Michael prayer together, he said, defend us in the hour of battle. I looked at him and I said, what are you trying to one-up me? Well, that's the way I've always said it, Charlie. He said, but I figured we'd get a little one-upsmanship in this time, too.
That's good. Well, next time I say it, I'm going to say in the instant instead of the day. In the instant. You can't beat that.
Until the next time, acknowledge God, take the next right step, and be a sign of hope.
Thank you, Charlie. It's been great.